Blog Talk Radio. golden ladders get slippery at the tops. And many a happy-go-lucky saint has made that long, long drop. If I make no waste, don't love me. I may tarry a while. I mean to know before I go, how come the devil's smile? Thank you.
did not hesitate to make that move, and you know, Larry Brown led them to a championship and back-to-back appearances in the NBA Finals in 04 and 05. So, again, you have an opportunity to win a title. It's about the here and now. You know what I mean? Especially with the collective bargaining agreement. You don't know how long. I mean, Paul George is going to be a free agent soon. So you don't, Lance Stevenson, you're going to pay him. 347-215-6180 is the call number on this latest edition of the Serial Coin Review. When we return, we will talk about Tiger Woods, who went out, who's out of the Masters. We'll talk about that and why are people knocking his legacy. That's coming up and so much more in this latest edition of the Serial Coin Review. We'll be right back. Is your call number on this latest edition of the Serial Coin Review. Final Four Saturday, National Championship on Monday night. 15 championships between the four schools. But Wisconsin hasn't won a championship since, I think, 1941. So it's been a number of years since they won a championship. Connecticut, Kentucky, and Florida are all recent winners of national championships. All those teams have multiple championships, with the exception of Wisconsin. So looking forward to that. The first game tips off 6:09 Eastern time with Florida and UConn. UConn, you know, led by Shabazz Napier, looking for a similar run that they had to 2011, which was led by, of course, Kemba Walker, Final Four MVP, of the Big East tournament that season. They went on on an 11-game winning streak. Won, I think, five games in the Big East to win the Big East tournament, and then the six games they won the NCAA tournament. Women's college basketball. Hopefully, we can get a Notre Dame UConn final. Notre Dame is the only team that's given Connecticut trouble in recent years. The Connecticut women's program is at such a level right now that it's almost bad for women's college. It is bad for women's college basketball. Yeah, now they will get, if they go undefeated, they will get a ton of publicity. But you know, they've had how many undefeated teams have they had? They've had at least three or four undefeated teams. I think this will be their fifth undefeated team. I know they were undefeated in 95, 2002. I don't think they were undefeated last season. They might have been undefeated last season, but I don't think they were undefeated last season. I think they have at least three undefeated teams in their history. So this probably, I think, would be the fourth. At some point, it's just like, you know, why even watch the game? I mean, Connecticut, this would be Gino Auriemma's ninth championship. Think about that, ninth championship if he wins. Like, they are so far ahead of any other program in college basketball. It's not even funny, especially now with Pat Summitt, you know, retired from Tennessee. Tennessee, you know, is nowhere near, not surprisingly so. You know, Pat Summitt was absolute icon of college, not only women's college basketball in general. I don't, I mean, again, I can't think that that's good for the sport when you have one team just completely just overwhelming the sport. So hopefully we can get a Connecticut-Notre Dame final, and hopefully, you know, hopefully for the sake of college basketball, Notre Dame wins that game. But again, have final for the men's Final Four in North Texas. Again, the UConn men going for championship number 4, which would put them in basically the top, put them top 5 of all time in college basketball history as a championship. So I would think, I always think that that would tie them with Duke for fifth all time in terms of championships. Only UCLA, Kentucky, Indiana, and North Carolina would have more than UConn. And it's really remarkable. Think about UConn 25 years ago. Think about UConn, you know, 25 years ago or 30 years ago before Jim Calhoun got there. Nobody knew. I mean, UConn was a non-factor. And look at the program now. Look at, you know, Kevin Ollie, 2 years after Jim Calhoun retires, takes over the program on probation last year, had no eligibility for the postseason tournaments, still had a very good season. Last year had they been eligible, they might have had a shot. They probably might have had a shot making the tournament last year, but they still won 20 games. He gets his team, which was okay in the regular season. I watched a number of UConn games. They were not nothing to scream about over the course of the season, and have gotten hot at the right time. Have some great senior leadership, good guards, some shooters, and tremendous defensively. They smothered Michigan State in that game on last Sunday. So UConn trying to get championship number 4. UConn all time 6-1 in the Final Four. That is the best winning percentage in Final Four history. Minimum three games. So we'll see if UConn can get another championship. So Tiger Woods, of course, is out of the Masters with the bad back, pinched nerve in his back. He could be done for the season, for the rest of the, at least for the Grand Slam season. All the remember the thing about golf is all the Grand Slams after the Masters, all the Grand Slams are kind of like somewhat bunched up together between the U.S. Open through the PGA Championship. So, you know, he could be back in September, but all again, the last Grand Slam would be middle of August, which would be the PGA Championship. And again, I'm not a doctor, you're not a doctor, so I mean, nobody knows when he's going to come back. But at minimum, he'll miss the Masters and also the U.S. Open, and probably the British Open as well. So if he can get back, he'll probably be, you know, would be for the PGA Championship. That's if he can get back. But despite that, there's been a lot of talk about what has transpired in the last 6 years. He hasn't won a major since 2008, of course, 2008 U.S. Open. And number of injuries. We know about the personal issues off the course. I mean, in his personal life, what happened, the divorce, and the whole ordeal in 2009. But there seems to be this growing sentiment that the last 6 years have kind of somewhat tarnished, you know, his dominance that he had from 97 through 2008, or really from 2000 to 2008 to 2009. And, you know, I've been reading some stuff, you know, his legacy will never be the same. What could have been? Like, it's remarkable, you know, how short of a memory that we have as a society. And I understand we live in a what have you done for me lately, but When you've taken into account that from 2000 to 2008, he entered 34 majors, won 12 of them, and was top five in 20 of the 34 majors that he entered, and only missed a cut once. I mean, that is the most, forget about that, is by far and away the most dominant stretch of golf ever. And to be honest with you, few athletes that have ever walked the face of this earth have ever had an 8 to 10 year run to where they were heads and shoulders above everybody else. Like Tiger Woods, there was no, you know, Tiger was compared to Jack. There was no, he had no rivals, no, nobody even close to him. Like the furthest, you know, the difference between Tiger and the number two player probably would be the same as the difference between the number two player and the number 150th player, to be honest with you. And that's how much better he was than everybody else. And again, he had 14 majors. He's won, you know, 79 victories on tour, which is second all time. He's third all time in terms of European victories with at 40, and he's not a permanent. He doesn't play a ton of European tournaments, but when he did play, he won. So I'm not gonna. You can't erase what he did and what he was just because you're frustrated that he's not the Tiger that he once was. The Tiger of 2000 and eight, the Tiger of 2000, 2004, 2007. That Tiger's done. He'll never be a dominant player again. I personally don't think he'll ever win a major. But that is, again, that doesn't take away the 14 majors that he did win. I mean, the worst thing you can say about Tiger Woods is that he's not as good as Jack Nicklaus, that his career won't be as good as Jack Nicklaus. Now, from a talent standpoint, I think Tiger Woods, from a pure talent standpoint, is the greatest golfer ever. But from a accomplishment in terms of wins, and that's what we go by, is Jack Nicklaus. Jack Nicklaus has 18 majors. Tiger has 14. But there's nothing wrong with number two. Like, what? Like, I know it sounds great. Let's be number one. I'm going for number one. That sounds great. But if somebody told you, somebody approached you and said, hey, you're going to be the second greatest thing. You're going to be the second greatest at blank. You're telling me you wouldn't sign up for that? Somebody said you were going to be the second greatest engineer of all time or the second greatest, you know, orthopedist or whatever. Whatever endeavor, teacher, whatever you're in, you wouldn't sign up for that today, like right now. I mean, please. I mean, Tiger Woods is a 1 in a billion athlete. I mean, that's all there is to it. Yeah, you're not gonna see that. Listen, forget about Jack's record. Nobody's touching Jack's record. Nobody's gonna approach 14 majors. I'll say nobody will even approach 10 majors. There are too many talented players on the tour now. It's spread out. Guys don't even win multiple majors in a year anymore. So, you know, it does nothing. If Tiger Woods doesn't win another tournament, his legacy, and that's been an overused term in sports recently, legacy. His legacy is set in stone. He's on Mount Rushmore, okay? He's on there with Nicklaus, Bobby Jones, Ben Hogan, you know, whoever you else want to put, I mean, you know, you want to put Arnold Palmer on there, whoever. He's on the Mount Rushmore, without question. Walter Hagen, whoever. So, again, enough already about, you know, Tiger Woods and this legacy talk. His legacy is set in stone, period. 347-215-6180 on this latest edition of the Cyril Gorman Review. We'll be right back with another edition of Are You Kidding Me? That's coming up on this latest edition of the Cyril Gorman Review.
Till the battle of the day is won. sick and tired, but you'll be a sad mind from you. Will you remember the famous men who had to fall to rise again? So take a deep breath, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, over again.
10:57 in the AM on this latest edition of the Silicon Review, 347-215-6180 is your call number as we discuss the world of sports. Deion Sanders comes out earlier this week and says, you know, he loves Johnny Manziel. He was drafted number one. But the reason why people are criticizing Johnny Manziel, and he's such a polarizing figure, is the fact that he has, or in Deion's opinion, I shouldn't say fact, but in Deion's opinion, he has ghetto tendencies. Yeah, he said, he's quoted. He actually said it. He has ghetto tendencies. And I first heard that, other than...
Are you kidding me?
It was like, Deion, did you really say that, Deion? Johnny Manziel has ghetto tendencies. I'm going to read you, if you don't know what the term ghetto means, we school here on the Circle Review. We educate as well as talk sports. Ghetto, part of a city in which members of a minority group live, especially because of social, legal, or economic pressure. Last time I checked, Johnny Manziel and his family were loaded. Last time I checked. Grandfather in the oil business. You know, he's going to the NBA Finals. That's the last time I checked that he was privileged. So, again, I'm trying to find... I don't think Johnny Manziel grew up in a ghetto. I've never seen his house before, but I don't think that he... Yeah, I don't think he grew up in a tough urban environment. I don't. I mean, there are enough stereotypes going around that characterize African Americans or minority groups. Some are true, some are not. Some are, some we laugh at, some are just asinine. It depends on what's said. But for Deion Sanders, who is, by the way, African American, to go out there and make a comment like that, first of all, you gotta explain, you gotta have your words and you gotta have the word match up with the context in which you're trying to use it. Doesn't make sense. Ghetto tendencies. What is it? Explain to me what is a ghetto tendency. Deion never explained that. And Deion, he tried to explain it as, Manziel being his personality, being flamboyant. It's not like Deion. It doesn't make sense. Now, if Deion would have came out and said, Manziel's flamboyance annoys people. And that's why I love him, because I once, too, was flamboyant as prime time, the whole coming out of Florida State, dancing, end zone dances. I can relate. If he had broken down that way, then that would have been fine. I just wonder, and I like Deion Sanders. He does a tremendous job on the NFL Network, breaking down the games, says what he feels, doesn't bite his tongue. But I just wonder what these guys are thinking when they make these comments. And, I don't think this was the thing that bothers me is I don't think this was an impulsive comment. This wasn't, this wasn't a guy coming off a bad loss and somebody sticking a microphone in his face 2 minutes after the game. Or this wasn't Richard Sherman with Aaron Andrews sticking a microphone in his face after he made a tremendous play, emotional game, NFC Championship. No. So Deion Sanders had plenty of time to think this through before he made this comment, which makes it worse. And he said this on the Tom Joyner Morning Show at the time with Roland Martin. I guess Roland Martin was filling in for Tom Joyner. And Roland Martin did an awful job of just not pushing the issue and basically took Dion off the hook. And then, you know, I mean, he didn't challenge Dion at all, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of what Dion said. Basically, you know, it was one of those, I'm happy that Deion Sanders is on the show with type interviews, if you know what I mean. Fluff questions. No big deal that you're making a just absolute ignorant comment. That demeans, you know, minorities. Even though I'm sure that wasn't Deion's intention. And by the way, it doesn't make any sense. In the context that he used they used the word, it makes no sense. Pro days. So Vinny and Cloudy had a pro day. We saw Johnny Manziel have a pro day. We saw Teddy Bridgewater have a pro day. And I'm just wondering what am I supposed to think about pro days? What are we supposed to? What do we learn? What do we really learn about a particular player, NFL player, during a pro day? We understand that it is a way for the NFL and the NCAA to promote their various sports. I mean, the NFL does it so that it's building up towards the draft. Is promoting, you know, helping promoting Johnny Manziel as far as Johnny Football, Jadeveon Clowney, next great pass rusher. So we understand what the NFL uses it for. Understand what the NCAA uses it for. You know, look at our campus, look at our guy, look at Johnny. You know, they're trying to draw in recruits. So I understand what the NCAA uses it for. Why should I care about Pro Day? We'll get back to that. Ladies and gentlemen, joining us right now on this latest edition of the Serial Court Review, a special guest who's been on here a number of times. Haven't spoken to him in a long time, but I'm glad to have him on right now. Mark Malusis, how you doing, buddy?
What's going on, Cheryl? How are you, man?
Doing fine, Mark. Busy weekend of sports, of course, with the Final Four and then with your baseball season opening. You had last night the Tanaka start. Seven strong innings, strikes out eight. No, he gave up the early home run to Melky Cabrera. What did you see in that start that you liked, and what are some things that would maybe concern you about him?
Well, I mean, what you saw that you liked is certainly the strikeouts and, a little bit of grit, not a kind of an inauspicious start when the first batter you face, as you mentioned, he gives up a home run to Melky Cabrera in his Major League Baseball debut, but to be able to bounce back from there. Listen, he wasn't completely dominant, but it's going to be a work in progress. The ability to get the fear that you had about guys coming over from Japan, where you've seen it before, where they've had a tremendous amount of success, is the fear. And you saw with Dice K, up with Boston, the fear of challenging major league hitters, and you did not see that fear last night from Tanaka. He's not going to go undefeated, certainly. And, if the split finger's not working, he'll probably have a penchant to giving up a home run, certainly in the ballpark that he pitches in, Cyril in the Bronx. But overall, I thought it was a very workmanlike Major League Baseball debut, a winning one. The Yankees even up their mark at 2-2 on the season, and Tanaka does his job.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly like the fact. I mean, yeah, he has a nasty split finger fastball. I mean, that thing drops like, you know, he's going to strike out a lot of people with that pitch, just that pitch alone. He is probably, I think, Mark, would you agree with this? He is probably the most important part of their pitching staff, considering in terms of their starting pitching staff, considering that I don't know what to expect from CeCe Sabathia. I know he got rocked against Houston. That wouldn't concern me as much as the fact that his velocity right now seems he just can't crack 90 miles in terms of velocity. So do you think Tanaka, you know, forget about the money that they spent. We know the Yankees print their own money, so that's not even my concern. But how vital do you think Tanaka is to the Yankees' success this season?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, they paid him $155 million, $175 million in total with the posting fee. I think he is the most important pitcher on that staff. You know, you have concerns about Sabathia. Nova can be very, very hit and miss. You know, Kuroda, you're concerned about him in the second half. You're not exactly sure what you're going to get from a Michael Pineda. So, you know, you work your way down the line, and you need, and I said in the offseason, that even though I've never seen a pitch on the major league level, and, you know, we know the reports, and we've seen the highlights of what he was able to do over in Japan, and he's in the prime of his career, 25 years of age. You know, Tanaka's the pitcher that I most trusted in that Yankee rotation right now. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear to see that is indeed the case. I think he is an important cog. If the Yankees are to get to October baseball, they've got issues as far as the infield is concerned now with the bulky hamstring for Teixeira. Second base is an issue. Shortstop Jeter at this stage of his career, even though I think DJ will probably hit pretty well. People have reservations, and understandably so, about shortstop. And then you look at third base. Certainly, Tanaka's got to go out there and do his job and pitch pretty well.
This is nothing new, Mark, as far as pressure of managing in New York. You know that as well as I do, as far as, you know, watching all the managers throughout the course during your time covering sports, Torrey and a number of Met managers. But I get the sense that this year for the Yankees that Girardi, and I know he signed the contract extension, so he's not going anywhere, but there's the pressure this year to win, considering what the Red Sox did, considering how good the Tampa Bay Devil Rays are, considering how much money the Yankees spent in the offseason. Girardi's in a tough spot as far as with that, and also how to handle an aging superstar, even though it's his last year, in terms of Derek Jeter. You know, do you think this is the most pressurized managerial year that Girardi's had since he's been in New York as a Yankee manager?
I don't know if it's the most pressurized. I think anytime you're
maybe
in
2009.
New York, yeah, I would probably say 2009 was. They spent a lot of money going into that offseason. In that offseason going into that year, I think that was a pressurized situation. Certainly making the playoffs, and the Yankees, they spent, you know, nearly $500 million. I think pressure comes along with the job. I think that's the best way to put it. If you don't want to deal with that, New York's not the spot for you. I don't know if I'd say it's the most pressurized, because I think there are issues with this team, and right now you have major reservations of whether or not they're going to be resolved in a positive fashion. It's not a all-star team all over the place where if this team does not respond or play well, that you're saying what gives. It's got to be the manager. Like we talked about, the infield's an issue. Bullpen, certainly. Robertson replacing Mariano Rivera. The age to this team, the amount of time off he's going to have to give to guys, resting guys, giving them DH opportunities as well. You know, I do think it's a tricky team to manage, but I don't know if I'd say it's the most pressurized scenario that he is in.
Mark, why hasn't this franchise adapted to what baseball is today? And what I mean by that is, you know, they go out there and they spend a ton of money, but that, frankly, is not what is winning championships for the most part. I was looking at farm system rankings. They rank like, I saw Keith Law give them, like, they ranked, like, 20th in terms of their farm system versus, you know, a team like, you know, Boston was, like, number one. Even what the Mets are doing right now with the young pitching, they're in the top 10, like, ranked, like, 6th. It just seems like they're trying to, like, the Yankees are caught in between of not wanting to rebuild. And I know they have the stadium trying to fill seats, Yes Network, the whole bit. But, you know, that hasn't won championships. And plus, you know, you know this as well as I do. These teams, you know, Buster Posey's, the Mike Trout's, those guys are being locked up early and very early on, which thins out the free agent market. Why haven't, again, why is it so, where are the Yankee prospects at, as far as the farm system and what have you?
Well, I mean, they haven't drafted well. I don't think there's any question about it. You know, you look at this team and this organization and franchise, they've spent a lot of high draft picks on pitchers. A lot of those pitchers have suffered major arm injuries or haven't lived up to expectations. You know, Betances is with this team now, but, you know, you start hearing about Dylan Betances about 3 years ago. Manny Benuelos suffered a significant arm injury. A lot of their high picks haven't worked. And certainly they haven't really done a great job of international signings or really in the collegiate or amateur draft. And that's a problem. And I agree with you. I think for the long-term success forward, there has been an adaptation in Major League Baseball where you're going to become less and less reliant on signing big-time free agents. Some will come across the way here and now and then, but it's got to be about player development moving forward, and the Yankees are behind the eight ball.
Before I move on to the Mets, give me a number as far as the Yankees in terms of wins this year. What do you see?
You know, I said anywhere between 84 and 95 wins. You know, I think that's probably the number, probably somewhere in between. I think they're going to be a playoff contender, probably a wild card contender in the American League, but that's probably where I come at, Ciro.
Wow, that's a big gap. I mean, that could be not making the playoffs or winning a division title. Like
But you look at it. I mean, you know, I think it's fair to have concerns about this team. Plus, you look at the overall strength of the American League East. I think it's a pretty good division. The Rays, the Orioles, the Red Sox. You know, I think the Blue Jays are going to be improved coming off last year in their disappointing season. So, yeah, I know there's a wide variety, but this is no longer the division that the Yankees rule. I think if those that have questions about the Yankees have every right to question just how good this team's going to be.
So you really think that there is the room for error is very small in terms of injuries or if guys don't step up, things of that nature, that is smaller than it has been in past years. You wouldn't say that.
Well, I think there's importance on the pitching staff more so this year than any other year. You know, I do like the guys that they brought in. I had no issue with how they handled the offseason, even losing Robbie Cano, you know, and letting him walk away and sign that 10-year, $245 million, $240 million deal that he signed with the Seattle Mariners. I don't have any issue with that, but, yeah, I think there is a – you know, if the pitch is decidedly average, if Kuroda shows more wear and tear this year than he did a year ago, if the setup guys don't do a good job for Robertson, if Robertson doesn't do a good job closing games out, I do think there is, you know, issues that this team potentially could face. Therefore, I put that, like, 8-9 game gap in between where I think they fall win-wise.
Yeah, I had no problem with them. The Robinson Cano thing, you know, he's a great player, but, you know, these 10-year contracts, we see that they have not worked out. So no problem with letting him go from that standpoint, but I don't need Kevin Long making comments about his work habits and stuff like that after the fact when the guy has been one of the best players in baseball over the last 5 years. So they need to hear from Kevin Long in terms of that. So, I mean, that part could just, let the guy walk without, you know, trying to smear his reputation. Even though he doesn't run out ground balls, but, you know, there have been a number of great players who didn't run out ground balls. The guy is a tremendous player. How about the Mets, Mark? Not 1-3, get their first win last night. Now, that was the first and last losses to Washington were brutal because the bullpen blows up in game one, and then in the third game, you catch a major break with no Jordan Zimmermann. You have a guy who, you know, the average casual fan probably never even heard of, Tamir Roark, go out there and, you know, basically shut you down. So, you know, the Mets, you know, what were your thoughts on the opening four games of the Mets season so far?
Well, at least they found a way to win a game last night against the Reds in, you know, tough conditions out in Citi Field. But, you know, overall, when I look at this Mets team, I don't think you see a lot of answers for this team. The bullpen, which I thought was going to be a major weakness, has shown that to be over the course of the first four games. Parnell's already hurt, their closer. Valverde has assumed that spot. You have the first base situation. Now they've made a decision. It's going to be Lucas Duda for the foreseeable future. You like Duda going out there hitting a couple home runs. But, shortstop's an issue. Darnell behind the plate offensively has been very, very disappointing. Chris Young is already hurt. The rotation, you can't tell me the rotation is better this year than it was last year. With the best pitcher in their organization on the shelf for the entire season. You can't tell me they're better. And I look at the division. Listen, the Marlins aren't particularly good, even though they've got off to a hot start. The Phillies aren't particularly good. The Braves are taking a little bit of a step back. I mean, I think everyone's overwhelming favorite to win that division is the Washington Nationals. But with that being said, I look at the Mets and, I think probably the high water mark for the Mets, I said in the offseason, was probably around 500. Maybe I'm being a little bit kind. Maybe it's in the high 70s, but I don't think it's a 60 or 65 win team. I do think they'll find ways to win games. I think they spent some money in the offseason. I just don't think they did enough.
I'm glad you mentioned that point about spending money in the offseason. Listen, everybody knows that the Mets are gearing everything towards 2015. I think the Harvey injury took them somewhat off the hook as far as expectations this year. You have, Harvey, Syndergaard, Wheeler are the future of the Mets. We all know that. It's just a matter of them, like you said, spending some money, putting together an offense that can put up some runs. And the offense, some of those guys hit, the offense should be decent. The offense was pretty good last year. And I have no problem with the direction that the Mets are going in as far as, developing players. They've gotten a lot of draft picks. Farm system is pretty good. Why would Sandy Alderson come out and make a statement about 90 wins? Not so much predicting 90 wins, but just even throwing that number out there. I didn't get that. Was there any – what do you think his motives were for making that kind of statement?
Well, I think it was, I don't know if it was necessarily a statement. I think it was something that came out from an internal meeting that the Mets had. I think he's a little bit bothered that news did come out. But, I think he's trying to motivate and inspire. But, when it did come out, Cyril, I think everyone laughed. I think you laughed. I laughed. I think baseball
yes.
fans laughed. Mets fans laughed. Because, realistically, you look at this team. I mean, maybe you say they're a 500 team. Maybe you say they're a 78-win team. They by no stretch of the imagination, unless they supersede all talent-level expectations, do they look like or even resemble or come close to a 90-win baseball team? And they just don't look like it. Back of the baseball card, there's something to be said there. They don't scream 90 wins or a team that's going to go out there and jump up and surprise you this year. So I think that has a lot to do with the Mets going out there and trying to get a scenario of building up excitement for their team, because I think a lot of their fans right now are pretty disenfranchised and pretty annoyed about where the team is right now and how many losing seasons they've had to muddle their way through.
I think if you went out there, I think the fans, the New York fans, are as intelligent or and nowhere smart as anybody as far as understanding. I think the fans, if you went out there and were honest with the fans, I think they would be disappointed but could accept it. But when you start blowing smoke, basically, and again, Alderson certainly did not want that comment to come out, but when something like that does come out, it doesn't reflect well on your franchise without question.
No,
so do you think? Yeah, so you think the franchise is clueless when you hear stuff like that from the even though I agree with how they're going about building their franchise with the drafts and things like that, it kind of takes away from that when statements like that come out. Mark, a lot of stuff has went on, of course, in New York in general in terms of the sports world since we last talked. What are your thoughts on you know, shifting gears a bit to the Phil Jackson, getting to the Knicks, getting Phil Jackson and the future of their franchise with Jackson and Carmelo and 2015, that whole free agency period.
Yes, Cyril, I think it's great. I mean, I think I trust Phil in making the necessary and the right moves more so than Mills or Allen Houston or Jim Dolan. I think he's going to give this team a vision. You know, who knows if it works, but I do think it's undue criticism to say that he can't do it. I know he's never done the job because that's really besides the point. The question is giving him the opportunity, giving him the power, the control, and the opportunity to run this franchise basketball-wise as he sees fit. And, you know, for the first time in a while, I'm excited to be a Knicks fan because I think he's got a vision. I'm willing to play the risk and play that risk out with Phil Jackson more so than anybody else they have in that franchise at this point.
Are the Knicks fans, do you get the sense that the Knicks fans are confident that Phil can turn it around?
I think they're hopeful. I think some are confident, but I think more hopeful. I think more, I think that's the right word. I think it's hopeful. He's going to find a way they're going to win some games and he's going to be able to bring a championship to this team, more so than when they had Isaiah here, Scott Layden or Donnie Walsh or Grunwald or anybody else that's run this organization in the past number of years. I think they look at a guy that has won 13 NBA championships, 2 as a player, 11 as a coach, and is one of the great names in the history of the NBA. They're hopeful that he can do some of that winning and put the cherry on the top of his resume and career here in New York.
Do you think Carmelo Anthony will be a part of the future of the Knicks?
Yeah, no, if you believe what Phil had to say at his press conference, you do. He said that about building around Melo. He thinks Carmelo can take his game to another level. If I'm Carmelo, I'm excited about that. But it's also a matter of the vision that Phil has. He's got to fill Melo on the vision that he has when Melo opts out this summer. And you have every reason to believe that he's going to follow through with that game plan. And what other teams, whether it be, Houston and Chicago and their vision with Carmelo Anthony and which one he decides to go down. I think with everything being said, I think Carmelo wants New York. Obviously the Knicks, Phil Jackson, Dolan, they want Carmelo Anthony. Right now, at one point this year before Phil Jackson came aboard, I thought Melo would leave. At this point in time, I think Melo is going to stay.
Wow. It can go either way. If you're Phil Jackson, I think I don't know if he's decided on that yet in terms of Melo, because if he lets him go, he can draw 2 big-time free agents. If he keeps him, he gives him a better chance of drawing just 1 free agent. So, I mean, I guess you can go either way with that. I guess keeping him just will guarantee you to draw at least 1 top free agent, because I don't think a lot of guys want to come to a place where there's there's no talent, where there's nothing there. It should be interesting. It definitely, like I said, there are only a handful of guys in NBA history that have won championships. It's not that many. You have a guy with 13 of them, so that right there just lends credibility. Like I said, it seems to lend credibility to the franchise. And you don't believe that Dolan will have any interference, because we know that Dolan wanted Carmelo Anthony here, in New York. Donnie Walsh did not, or at least Donnie Walsh did not want to give up what they gave up for Carmelo Anthony. So we know he kind of interfered with that. Phil, you believe Phil has complete control to make, whether it's trades or signing guys, or if Phil says, you know what, I want Carmelo out, will Jim Dolan allow him to do that?
I don't think you can have full autonomy unless you own the team. So we talk about basketball power. I do think if Jackson feels strongly about something, Jackson's going to be able to make the necessary basketball move as he sees fit. But everyone uses the word autonomy and say, well, Jackson's got complete control. Jerry Jones has got control. Dolan's got control. Woody Johnson's got control. You go across the owners respective sport, the guy that owns the team has full autonomy. So you can never say that Phil Jackson has full autonomy, but I do think at this stage, with the disappointing season the Knicks have had this year, hopefully Dolan got humbled a little bit and that he is given, you know, and he will relinquish power, as he sees it, for a margin of time here. How long that will last, who knows? Do I think it's going to last the entire length of the 5 years that Phil Jackson is here? Probably not, because Dolan has shown you in the past that he does not work that way, and it takes him a while, and sometimes he's going to butt into it. As you mentioned it, butting in with the Melo deal with Donnie Walsh, so, and that relationship ended poorly. So odds are, if you were in Vegas right now, you'd bet that at Dolan, at some point over the course of the next 5 years, that Phil Jackson is hopefully here, that he's going to want to start to get involved. Hopefully that's not the case, but history tells you that it will be.
So you better answer to see over the next couple of years, because, again, Knicks have a number of contracts coming off the books in 2015 with Stoudemire, Bargnani, and Tyson Chandler. So they're going to have some flexibility. And, having Phil Jackson there, again, similar to Pat Riley, just that championship pedigree does make a difference, I feel, in terms of drawing guys and getting guys to selling guys on the ability to win championships with your franchise. So, again, the Knicks, at worst, the Knicks have somebody, again, that makes them relevant and makes somebody people take them seriously. So, at worst, they have that going for them moving forward. As always, Mark, it's been a pleasure. Certainly, I will we'll be talking again as the course of the baseball season moves on. We know it's a marathon. Thanks for joining the program.
Hey, Cyril, anytime, man. Always a pleasure. Good to hear from you, and have a great weekend, all right, bud?
You too. And I did not want to bring them up, so I didn't bring up Syracuse, because I know it's still a painful wound in terms of what happened, Mark. Like, what? I've rarely seen a collapse like that. I thought they were a championship team for most of the season.
Yeah, offensively, they got very stagnant. They played their best basketball. Obviously, first 25 games when they went undefeated, but, probably they peaked at, I would say, game 20 or 21 of the regular season, unfortunately. And offensively, they got very stagnant. C.J. Fair didn't get better. Down low, Christmas regressed. Jeremy Grant didn't add a lot offensively. And teams figured out Cooney, who was extremely hot early on in the season, Cyril, to start the season. So, and they didn't really have much offensive flow or game plan, and they didn't have an explosive score, and it came back to haunt them. I didn't, going into the tournament when the field of 68 was announced, I didn't have a lot of confidence at all that they had the potential of making a run to the Final Four.
Yeah, no question about it. As always, Mark, thanks for joining me. I'll see you next time.
Yeah, you got it, Cyril. Anytime, man. Be well.
All right, take it easy. Mark Malusis, as always, does a wonderful job with the Yankees, Mets, and the whole New York sports scene. That's going to wrap it up for this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. I will see you next week. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the Final Four. So long.